pleasure now to introduce to you this morning's speaker, Bernard O'Donohue, who was born in Cullen, County Cork. Bernard is a poet and critic, a lecturer and tutor in English at Magdalen College, Oxford. But in September, he makes a big move to become a fellow of Wadham College, Oxford. His collections of poems include Poaching Rights and The Weakness, published in 1991, which was shortlisted for the Whitbread Prize for Poetry. And a new volume, which is in Cohen's bookstore, Gunpowder, which draws on episodes of his upbringing in County Cork. Gunpowder was published this year as a Poetry Book Society choice. Bernard has also edited an anthology of medieval European love poetry entitled The Courtly Tradition. His most recent work is Seamus Heaney and the Language of Poetry, 1994. Last week he led a seminar on contemporary Irish poets, and this week on Yeats's later poems. This morning he speaks to us on the last poems with a slightly revised title, The Rights and Wrongs of Passionate Syntax in the Language of Last Poems. Bernard O'Donohue.
Please tell me if you can't hear. I'm an infamous mumbler, so you won't be out of order. Just to say something quickly about why I revised the title. I mean, the rather vague title I gave in the first place, when I gave it to Ron some time back, as Sources of Language in Last Poems, itself is meant to suggest a kind of awkwardness, and to talk about where the language of the last poems comes from in a very general kind of way, rather than particularizing sources in Irish usage, for example, that kind of thing. I'm also meaning to address in a very general way what has always struck me as a paradox or some kind of problem in the discussion of Yeats, which is how little is said about his language and how tentatively it is said when it is. I think the reason for that is perhaps because there's a sense that his usage is vernacular, and if you're excluded from Sligo usage, there may be things going on that you're unaware of. Now, generally speaking, I think there aren't. I think that the ways in which Yeats draws on local idiom, local construction and so on, are not very many and very recognizable when they do occur. So I think that the language of the poetry is a very literary language, and that's part of what I'm talking about today. I'm concentrating on the last poems because it seems to me that in last poems something becomes very marked and crucial and noticeable, which was present to some degree throughout his writing. And I think it goes hand in hand with a tendency for his language to become more dramatic. And the phrase I'm connecting that with is the famous phrase, which is on the in the first two quotations on that handout sheet, the phrase passionate syntax, which is much used, but in fact is a puzzling phrase, and I want to begin by questioning it. My argument in general, to synopsize it briefly to begin with, is that in creating this passionate syntax, the suggestion of passion in the construction of the language, Yeats is reverting consciously to a pre-corrected form of English. I mean, everybody knows that in the neoclassical period, the 17th and 18th century, English was gradually standardized and tightened. But the most common statement, the most familiar statement of it, I suppose, is Eliot talking about dissociation of sensibility, which is perhaps best understood in a linguistic context. But through the 17th and 18th century, the kind of copiousness and variety and irregularity of Elizabethan usage was seen to be in something of a crisis, and gradually the standard language was tightened, regulated, and created. So by the time of Johnson's Dictionary, in the 1750s, English has very fixed rules. Now, it's always been felt that there are considerable advantages, of course, in having a standard language. It offers a way of solving disputes. I mean, for example, if there are arguments about whether aristocratic or vernacular usage is better, you can resolve that kind of argument more democratically, which is the paradox, really, by having recourse to logic and reason. So a standardized form that resolves a dispute has a lot to be said for it. I think that's something we're very aware of in Ireland, because between the late 16th century and the 19th century, Irish was largely an unwritten language. And the consequence was, or one of the consequences, was that the neoclassic period passed it by altogether. And we're still suffering from that with the Irish language, which, for example, doesn't yet have an etymological dictionary, which is an extreme problem for people working on literature in the Irish language. Now, all that kind of thing was provided by the standardizing movement in the 18th century. However, it has also always been felt, and particularly by the Romantics, and I'm arguing here that it's a feeling that was echoed by the modernists at the beginning of the 20th century, that there are disadvantages as well as advantages in a fixed and regulated language. It's always been felt that there's a loss of the kind of expressiveness that you get with Elizabethan usage, and people always hankered back towards Shakespeare and towards the way you could say two things at once in Shakespeare's language. The possibility of saying two things at once was ruled out by the 18th century, who talked about divided usage, and they said explicitly that in any given linguistic circumstance where there are two possibilities, one is always preferable to the other. One is always right and one is always wrong. Now, I think that when Yeats, I think, is classically in the Romantic tradition in his wish to suggest vividness and passion and kind of theatrical liveliness in his language. And one of the ways of doing that is by breach of rule. And that is largely what I'm going to be talking about here, hence the rights and wrongs of passionate syntax. That is to say, you can achieve a right literary effect by a wrong usage. And that's what I'm going to be largely talking about today. That is the preamble and the synopsis, so I'm now largely in the position of the person who's about to read a poem, having told the story of the poem, which means there's not much point in reading it when you get to that stage. But anyway, I am now about to go into the main discussion. Well, on the first page of the handout sheet, I put that much-quoted passage, which a number of speakers over the last 2 weeks have alluded to as well, or quoted, the passage in a general introduction from my work, which I'm sure you know is a 1937 essay intended as the introduction to the complete edition of Yeats's works, which hasn't yet fully materialized. And there Yeats writes of the need for a passionate syntax for passionate subject matter. Passionate subject matter is clear enough. We all know about that. But passionate syntax might give us pause. It's a phrase that he used more than once, and it's been echoed by many of the critics of Yeats's language, especially of the language of the last poems. For example, Thomas Parkinson in his book, in his early book, 1953, which is an excellent discussion, I think, of the language of the last poems, and in many ways I think it hasn't been superseded. Parkinson follows the poet's lead in repeating the phrase every second page through the early part of his discussion in a sort of vague hope, I think, that with each mention, familiarity will somehow accumulate meaning. But I don't think it does become very much clearer by repetition. Now, there's no doubt, of course, that the adjective passionate applies very well to Yeats's later language in general. In a useful and familiar list, Randall Jarrell, again in an early essay, itemized typical early and late diction and vocabulary in Yeats. Very familiar things, really. The early vocabulary, things like dream, heart, rose, grey, pearl pale, and so on. And these give way to the later language, the language of lust and rage, I suppose, foul, ignorant, abstract, crazy, lunatic, mire. That's a selective abstract from Jarrell's list. And Jarrell, with his characteristic critical accuracy and gift for the mot juste, comments that the later words, quote, are full of violence, of toughness and strength. Some have a rhetorical magnificence, others a sensual colloquial sharpness. That's very well put, I think, and I think we don't need to be detained much by considering the vocabulary of Last Poems. That's been much discussed. But how can syntax, which after all is a linguistic mechanism by which words are combined into meaningful sentences, be passionate? It seems to be, on the face of it, part of the structure, the abstract structure of the language itself. So how can individual passion get into it? I'm not here going to go into later, more modern senses of syntax, the Chomskyan senses, though in fact I think that they would be very productive in an examination of Yeats. But it's the idea that syntax is part of the meaning-carrying element of the language in Chomsky and not just the basic structure itself. That sense of syntax wasn't available to Yeats, so it wouldn't have been in his head when he talked about passionate syntax. Parkinson, in his book, goes on to quote what was then an unpublished statement of Yeats, which is number 2 on the handout sheet, talking about passionate syntax again, which I think does clarify the matter to some degree. Yeats distinguishes, interestingly, between a poem which talks and one which sings. Broadly speaking, I think that corresponds to dramatic language and lyric language, and it's part of Yeats's general tendency not to distinguish, at least in its language, or perhaps also in its critical drift, between poetry and drama, at all. He says that in one which talks, that is to say, the language of the drama, quote, and I'm quoting from that bit that's on the sheet, we have the passionate syntax, the impression of the man who speaks, the active man, no abstract poet, the drama, and so on. But the occurrence of the word drama in the list, I think, is significant. He then turns revealingly, as you see, to one of his favorite whipping boys, who has always been a great whipping boy for the modernists, Tennyson, and he says, quote, Tennyson's syntax is seldom contorted. It is perhaps never good speech. It lacks the impulse of passionate life. In Memoriam, says Yeats, is detestable because of its syntax, which is putting it pretty strongly, really. Parkinson then leaves that and drifts away to a very interesting and I think important early discussion of metrics in Yeats, stuff that is, I think, now fairly familiar, the way that, following, I suppose, Thomas MacDonagh, ultimately, whom Parkinson recognizes, the way Irish metrical forms, by some kind of system of osmosis or something, gets into Yeats's practice. But that's been much commented on recently. But in going into the metrics in that discussion, Parkinson somehow escapes from passionate syntax, it seems to me. He's used the phrase 3 times in the previous 2 pages. So then he kind of wipes his brow and thinks, phew, you know, and escapes into something that he can be more particular about. There's one smaller paradox here, which I hope to resolve in the course of the discussion, but it's one that has considerable significance, I think, for Yeats and his contemporaries, and I'll come back to it. He says, Tennyson is never good speech because seldom contorted, which presumably suggests that conformity to syntactic rule, i.e. grammatical correctness, so to speak, is disabling for good poetic expression. Yet elsewhere we find Yeats claiming to achieve passionate syntax, using the same phrase, while observing the rule. I'm going to come back to this apparent contradiction later on, as endemic to modernist views of language and central to Yeats's own practice. That is to say, a modernist style, at least in some of its forms, could be said to be a style compounding observation of rule to the point of pedantry. And Yeats does that all the time. I think we can think of examples straight away. That rather kind of arch over-correctness that Yeats goes in for in his use of subjunctives, for example. But that is compounded with breach of rule in the same time. Colin Muir touched on this, I think, as on other things that I'm dealing with. In talking about Mangan, you know, the urn shall run red with redundance of blood, that running red and redundance, the kind of grand term side by side with colloquial usage. That applies, I think, in Yeats and grammar as well. But I want to look here briefly at the question of Yeats and modernism in the presence of far greater authorities than me on the matter. If modernism means anything very particular in language, and of course some of the authorities on the matter, like Hugh Kenner decried last week, have concluded that it doesn't really, that there isn't anything very particular to modernism in itself, apart from the general modern movement. Well, if it is specific, Yeats hasn't always fitted in well, as everybody knows. I mean, in listing the modernists, you begin confidently with Pound, Eliot, Joyce, maybe Apollinaire, taking it to other languages and so on. But there tends to be a brief pause before you push Yeats in, and he comes in as a kind of semi-modernist, I think, as late romantic. Now, clearly, there are ways in which he is modernist. I mean, as well as the matter of the later diction that can be demonstrated as it is by Jarrell, the modernist construction and organization of a poem like 1919 is evident as well. I mean, the six sections of various subjects and forms, recalling the wasteland, obviously, and of course that kind of sequence poem is something that Yeats uses repeatedly, particularly from the Tower onwards. You could see, in a way, that sequence poem, the linking together of different formal kinds of poem as a single poem, as the modernist long poem, if you like. I mean, when people find it difficult to write the long poem, what they seem to write instead is this sequence, which is held together much more loosely in keeping with modernist aesthetic, maybe. But I think I want to press on to a more difficult and, I think, compelling matter, really. Is there a modernist syntax? Can you talk about modernist grammar? Is that, in fact, what Yeats means by passionate syntax? Well, I think immediately the idea has some plausibility when you consider some of the traditional definitions of modernism. Disrupted forms, the heap of broken images, and so on. I mean, the notion of wrong grammar as fitting in there is by no means a surprising one. There is an interesting discussion of this that I should recognize at this point by Richard Shepherd in Bradbury and Macfarlane's Pelican book called Modernism, the general discussion of European modernism. Shepherd has some interesting things to say about Yeats in passing, and his essay as a whole, I think, is one of the best discussions of how disrupted grammar and syntax fits into the crisis of the expressive power of language as a whole. I'm mentioning that just to pay tribute, you know, to an important earlier discussion. But to return to Yeats's revealing and striking criticism of Tennyson, the diction seldom contorted. We take it then he means that syntax should and not seldom be contorted and disrupted and broken if it is to be passionate and not detestable like in Memoriam. So I want to press on to look at some Yeats syntax in particular, taking late really to mean from the Tower onwards, though mostly concentrating on the last poems. To begin with, though, here are some familiar lines from The Winding Stair, the number 4 on the handout sheet, those lines from Blood and the Moon. "And God appointed Berkeley, that proved all things a dream, that this pragmatical, preposterous pig of a world, its pharaoh that so solid seem, must vanish on the instant, if the mind but change its theme." Now, the diction of this is immediately remarkable. The collocation of the colloquial pig of a world with pragmatical, I mean, not just pragmatic, but pragmatical, that's the old-fashioned kind of arch sound of Yeats. It adds up to a mixed register that on the face of it is a decidedly unpoetic kind. Similarly, the morphology, the word formation there, is very attention-seeking, particularly in the adjective God-appointed as a compound. But the oddest thing, and perhaps the most anti-poetic, in quotes, is the ugly inverted phrase, "its pharaoh that so solid seem." What's that doing there? I mean, to find a similarly awkward piece of syntax, I think you have to turn to things like local ballads and the like. You know, "the captain, he was sober," that kind of thing, or "her hand to me did give," that sort of forced disruption of world order. But one other thing, the phrase also contains a kind of pre-corrected, a pre-18th century, so to speak, breach of concord in grammatical rule. Pharaoh that so solid seem. Now, I think this will be more jarring to the Americans here than to the Europeans, because the American language went on being corrected for 50 years longer than English, as I'm sure you know. So American is more correct than English and more observing of grammatical rule. So pharaoh seem is just about okay in English or Irish English usage, but I think is more jarring on American ears. But nevertheless, it clearly is a defiant, I think, usage of something that is not technically correct. And there's one other awkwardness of syntax which might be thought unidiomatic here, and that's that rather arch subjunctive, which is very much favored by Yeats, if the mind but change. The colloquial version of that will be if the mind just changes its theme, rather than but change its theme. Very much favored throughout Yeats, increasingly so in later Yeats. It's very hard to find a late Yeats poem of any length that doesn't have a subjunctive in it. That's an interesting challenge, really. And we might recall here the Muldoon parody in Seven Midas Street that somebody mentioned last week. It begins, Auden's talking about Yeats in that poem, begins by saying, very, very neatly, as Muldoon always is neat, he says, "And were Yeats living at this hour?" Everybody notices that he jokes about the word certain, certain men, certainly not, and so on. I mean, Yeats uses the word certain as a kind of tick, really. But were Yeats living is just as much a kind of tick of the late Yeats, I think. So what we have in these famous lines from Blood on the Moon is an odd mixture of the sort of archly overcorrect subjunctive side by side with the kind of erroneous, the wrong breach of concord. Now, there's certainly a vigor about this kind of syntax that might, like the mixed vocabulary, you know, like pragmatical and pig of a world, be called passionate. And I think it is a breach of rule and syntactic mix, which certainly wouldn't have been admissible before the rule-making of the 18th century. It wouldn't have been admissible by the according to the principles, the neoclassical principle of the 18th century. And it's one that the early Romantics worked against very deliberately. I'll talk about Keats in a minute briefly. But the Victorians gradually got out of the system. They went back towards corrected forms, hence the detestability of In Memoriam, as Yeats sees it. But this point about breach and observation of rule is one that I want to return to at some length as my main subject, I mean, as I've said already. I recall something Declan Kybert said last week. He said, quote, "Irish modernism always works by summoning the unfamiliar under the familiar." It's the same kind of principle, I think. It's very much what modernism does. It mixes the familiar with the unfamiliar, the regular with the irregular, and so on. It comes to the same kind of thing. But I think it isn't only Irish modernism that does that. All modernism does. And for that matter, I think it isn't just modernism that does. I think it's a kind of aesthetic universal, if you can talk about such a thing. You probably can't, of course, but you might propose it as that. I want to take a second example of the syntax of late Yeats, a very famous one. One from a later period, from deep into the last poems, and from a poem which again is familiar and celebrated as even more magnificently reckless, really, than Blood on the Moon, and that's the poem High Talk. I remember in the 1989 rash of celebrations of Yeats for the centenary, Tom Paulin wrote an interesting piece, I think, in the London Independent about Yeats, and this was the poem that he took as being Yeats at his greatest achievement, the kind of wild language that took expression beyond the reach of anybody else. I'm quoting selectively from it here. The whole poem is on the sheet. It's a sonnet of a kind, as you can see. "Processions that lack high stilts have nothing that catches the eye. What if my great-granddad had a pair that were 20 foot high?" And then towards the end, "Malachy Stiltjack am I. Whatever I learned has run wild, from collar to collar, from stilt to stilt, from father to child. All metaphor, Malachy, stilts and all. A barnacle goose, far up in the stretches of night, night splits, and the dawn breaks loose. I, through the terrible novelty of light, stalk on, stalk on. Those great seahorses bare their teeth and laugh at the dawn. Now, it's a very difficult poem in all kinds of ways, but one of the difficulty is compounded, I think, of various linguistic effects. As with the lines from Blood and the Moon, the oddnesses of idiom and diction are immediately striking. The colloquial great-granddad, for example, 20 foot, not 20 feet. The morphological, the word formation oddness, Malachy Stiltjack. The breach of idiom, I think, with night splits. I mean, night doesn't split. I mean, it's not a recognized verb for what happens to night when it becomes dawn, and so on. It's a very long way from traditional poetic diction. But there are a few less noticeable things that also, I think, have equal significance. Noting that the poem is a very extraordinary sonnet with very long lines, and it's in rhyming couplets, as a sonnet never is. I want to say some of the same kind of things that I thought Anne Fogarty said very brilliantly about Lead and the Swan last week in the analysis of that. Here, I think, it reminds us of modernism's predilection for a mixture of formal structure and the irregular. That's back to that Kyburg point a bit, I think. But that general idea that I keep hammering here, that modernism likes to work with formal structures and breaches of formal structure. I mean, this is a very familiar notion in Irish modernism and perhaps in all modernism. The way, for example, that the tight Homeric parallel in Ulysses provides a framework that enables the novel's bricolage, you know, to have kind of free rein. The novel can go all over the place because there is some sense of a tight structure that contains it. Clearly, this leads into other thoughts about structuralist theory, I mean, as it's defined in psychology and anthropology and so on. The notion of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts, kind of gestalt theory, which modernism clearly fits into. Other modernist shaping literary frameworks, mythic ones, are too familiar to need enumeration. I mean, things like the story of the Fisher King and the wasteland, for example. What holds the wasteland together? So that its kind of looseness can operate is something like a mythic structure. And again, these lines of Yeats can hardly be accused of being seldom contorted in the kind of wildness of their association of ideas. So they clearly pass his test for passionate syntax and give us an idea of what he meant by that. I think he means this kind of writing. If the form of the sonnet here has some influence on the shape of the poem, at least in its 14 lines and its recurrent regularities, its elements, I think, owe something to another constraining poetic formality. I'm going to mention Thomas Parkinson for the last time. I mean, at the end of his book on the later poetry, Parkinson shows from the manuscripts how the meaning of the poems was sometimes influenced by demands of rhyme. In a very fascinating analysis, particularly of section 2 of Vacillation, the lines that followed What is Joy, the ones that Ron Shuhart went on to discuss last week. I think what Parkinson says there anticipates the most important structuralist analysis of Yeats. I'm not going to spend a long time with structuralism, but there's one point I want to pick up from structuralist practice that I think is extremely enlightening for this matter of syntax. Well, the most famous structuralist essay is the familiar one by Jacobson and Rudy on the sorrow of love. What they do in that essay is to analyze the poem under the headings of various linguistic categories, grammar, syntax, phonology, part of speech, you know, word class, and so on, in order to show how the 1891 2 version changes its meaning into the post-vision 1925 one, while retaining its 12 line-ending rhyme words. It's the same kind of exercise as Walton Litz was conducting so interestingly yesterday. One of Jacobson Rudy's most striking observations deals with the phonic the sound relationship between the operative words of the poem's title, which I think is extremely illuminating, sorrow and love, the sorrow of love, and the words of the poem's opening line in either version. The first line is, the brawling of a sparrow in the eaves, sparrow and eaves. Now, the rhyme word for eaves in both versions, is leaves. So this may be blind obvious, and it may have occurred to everybody when they first read the poem, but it was a new thought to me, and I thought a very interesting one, that a poem called The Sorrow of Love, that begins with a pair of rhymes, which is sparrow and eaves or leaves, sorrow, love, sparrow, leave, is surely not accidental. That is not, it must have been calculated in some way. There's some kind of mutual influence between those things. And they go on to extend that kind of analysis to other places in Yeats as well. In other words, where the meaning is determined not just by what is wanted to be said, but by some other linguistic constraint. Now, this is briefly departing from the matter of syntax and drawing very selectively on the Jacobson-Rudy essay, but I'm going to go back to related syntax. It's a very brief excursus, this. I want to relate it too to High Talk, the poem we've just been looking at, a poem with a progression which is much looser in association than either version of The Sorrow of Love. The central image in the poem is the circus, paralleling, of course, Yeats's late Ars Poetica, the circus animal's desertion, here with, you know, piebald ponies, led bears, caged lions, and so on. We might also note the phrase, from collar to collar, from stilt to stilt. Now that works pretty well for circus animals, doesn't it? I mean, they're collared, and you get clowns on stilts and so on, so it works very well for the circus. But I also think it works extremely well for Yeats's general use of the circus as metaphor. The way poetics works as a mixture of the constraint, the collar, and the stilt, the affectation. You've got to have both things, you know, Yeats believes. You've got to be aspiring and having grand thoughts and grand expressions, and at the same time have fixed, imposed, and chosen constraints, like rhyme, meter, and so on. The central idea that the image of the circus represents, of course, is that artistic aspiration has to be realized through exalted and maybe artificial expression, to be on stilts, and by implication perhaps to be stilted. We remember that by the time you get to the circus animal's desertion, these stilts actually use the phrase stilted boys. As we were saying the other day in a seminar, in fact, I mean, the phrase stilted actually doesn't mean on stilts. You can't say, I went out into the street and I saw a stilted man. It doesn't mean that. So you're more than halfway to the metaphorical sense of affected, kind of overreaching, overarching, which is the sense that Yeats wants to carry. We might also note, bearing Jacobson-Rudy in mind, that the verb describing the poet on stilts in the poem three times is stalks. I don't want to sound obsessed by this, but it both rhymes and alliterates with the poem's title, High Talk. It doesn't alliterate, I'm sure I don't know. But it talk, stalk, clearly is the same kind of suggestive derivative. Now, whether the title suggested the image or the image suggested the title would be an interesting thing perhaps to reflect on. You could just toss a coin, I suppose, because clearly titles can either predate or post-date poems. But clearly there's that kind of connection again. There's the same phonic link that that Jacobson-Rudy talk about. Now, I don't want to spend too long with structuralist terminology, as I say, but just to summarize on it, I think it offers a clarifying way of expressing how exactly Yeats is disrupting normal syntactic procedure. Jacobson says that what poetic language does is to disrupt the relationship that normally exists between association by likeness and association by contrast. In a famous, rather difficult sentence, very much quoted, which I'll then go on to expound, he says, quote, the poetic function projects the principle of equivalence from the axis of selection into the axis of combination. I'm quoting that partly to suggest that, you know, what Jacobson says is, you know, is a bit of an ordeal. You know, I mean, you have to take a day to it, really. What he's saying is, very enlighteningly, I think, in literature, we don't just select words to form a meaningful sequence, as you would if somebody asked you what the time is, and say, you say 10 past 10 or whatever. But we choose to operate by other pre-selected constraints as well. Things like meter and so on, the decasyllabic line and all the rest of it. An obvious one, repetition of metaphor. So on this point, for instance, you have said, it's a very curious thing to say when you kind of defamiliarize it after all, I insist that what I want to say about high talk, whatever that is, in this poem, should be in 14 lines, it should involve rhymes, it should contain a word that echoes the title, and so on. But all those things are chosen constraints that don't operate in normal language. It's how poetic language works. This is very obvious. We might notice, too, that André Breton says a very similar thing. I'm quoting it because he said it in 1924 in his book, The Disdainful Confession. This is in Richard Shepherd's translation from the essay I mentioned before. He says, the modern poet, quote, abstracts words from their conventionalized place in speech and recombines them in such a way that their forgotten secondary potential, that is, their connotative properties, their rhythmic and oral possibilities, similarities with other words, forgotten meanings, and so on, become primary. It's interesting to reflect, 1924, I mean, that's before structuralism got anywhere near literature, and yet the principle that he is expounding, I think, is precisely the same as what the structuralists after Saussure say. I mean, that what belongs to one level of the language, not the paradigmatic level in Saussure's terms, gets into the syntactic level. So the syntax is concerned with constructing the meaning of sentences, but syntax is affected by the choices that usually belong somewhere else in modern poetry. That's Breton's phrase as well. This has been gone into at some length, as perhaps some of you know, by Joseph Adams in his book Yeats and the Mass of Syntax in 1984. But it's a rather difficult book, I think, and his sense of the word syntax is quite, it remains fairly elusive. It's very interesting, I think. Right, well, I mean, poetry introduces then a new set of syntagmatic requirements, the requirements of syntax in various ways. And the most obvious of those are metaphor, likeness of image, and assonance, likeness of sound. Jacobson also says that equivalence in sound inevitably involves semantic equivalence in meaning, which is the same kind of point. I'm trying to think of a fairly kind of light-hearted illustration of that, and I thought of the following Irish one, really. If you're asked what the time is, and it happens to be 9:50, and you say 10 to 10, there's, in my part of the Irish countryside at least, there used to be a tendency for people to say, to pronounce it in Cork and Kerry accents, tin to tin, and then add, as a kind of whimsical thought, tinker's time. So you say, what time is it? Tin to tin, tinker's time. That's quite interesting, I think. That is a literary addition, in fact, because you're not just telling the time and letting the message melt away. You're actually staying with the actual words themselves and thinking of them as words and pondering what tin to tin sounds like, and bringing in another kind of sort of phonic equivalence or whatever. Okay, to summarize with reference to high talk and get away from the structuralists, several of the usual constraints operate there. The 14 lines, though untypically for a sonnet, they're made up of 7 rhyming couplets. Nevertheless, they stick to that. The poem sustains the same running metaphor, poetic formality, as stilts. But it does some other things too, typical of late Yeats, and typical, I'm suggesting, of the disruptions and gaps of modernist language. One is the rhetorical question in line 2. The reason that I, the principal reason that I issued these protective handout sheets was that I want to dwell in some detail on a few points of language for the next few minutes. The second line, what if my great-granddad had a pair that were 20 foot high? Strictly speaking, the phrase ought not to be what if. It ought to be what does it matter if. The phrase used in Dialogue of Self and Soul, what matter if the ditches be impure. He doesn't really mean what if he had 20 foot high stilts. What follows from that? And when you think of it and look at it closely, the second sentence, so to speak, the sentence beginning from line 2 of High Talk, doesn't really make sense. Or at least if it does make sense and we understand what it says clearly enough, it doesn't quite say what we understand it to say. I take it that we understand it to say this. The required interpretation is, what does it matter if my grandfather's stilts were 20 feet and mine are only 15? Nobody else is higher than 15 nowadays. And in any case, some rogue has stolen mine, such as they were, for an inferior purpose, like the famous literary coat. But it doesn't quite say that because of the oddness of the idiom, what if, at the beginning. It seems a small point, but it's absolutely typical of the way that Yeats plays around with idiom in later poetry, and does so increasingly. And it's one of the ways in which he defamiliarizes, which he creates his modernist language. There's an obvious previous instance of this. When the Edinburgh Reviewers raged about Keats's Endymion, one of the things they complained about was obvious things like sentences without main verbs and so on. In other words, when the 18th century had been to all this trouble to create correct rules, Keats, like Jane Austen, came along and flouted them, broke all the rules for his own literary purposes, and they didn't like it. But when it says, spite of despondence of the inhuman dearth of noble natures, he doesn't mean spite of despondence, he means in spite of despondence or despite despondence. He could, in fact, perfectly metrically have said despite despondence. It's a quite deliberate choice of an unidiomatic, incorrect usage. And I think Yeats does that a lot in phrases like what if here. To take one other, a more familiar example, equally kind of delicate, but I believe, true. In Lapis Lazuli, where it says, everybody knows or else should know, that if nothing drastic is done, airplane and Zeppelin will come and so on. Everybody knows or else should know. He doesn't mean or else. He means or at least should know. Everybody knows or at least they should know because it's important. To say everybody knows or else should know is to say nothing at all, in fact, because the or else just gets rid of the original proposition. It's the same deliberate straining of idiom as a general implication, I think, that language is feeling the strain, that point about modernist language. I'm sidestepping, of course, the old intentionalist argument about how we know what Yeats meant. Strictly speaking, that's not what is said. I think all the time an important part of the effect of poetry depends on a belief in intentionalism. It's concerned with the relation of its language to the abstract rules on which it's based. In High Talk, then, passionate language is expressed through the diction, the passionate diction, the long-line versification, morphology, and these kind of idiomatic raggednesses. But here, passionate syntax means the breach of syntactic rule to give an impression of excitement, to go back to that number 2 on the handout sheet again, the idea of the drama, the impression of the man who speaks, the active man, no abstract poet, the syntax of common passionate life. I'm suggesting that Yeats deliberately blurs idiomatic connectives in particular, like despite and what if and so on, in order to suggest the way that the speaking voice in conversation, when it's excited, tends to be guilty, so to speak, of breach of idiom. And the rule-governed nature, to use Bloomfield's term, of well-formed prose is suspended for that purpose, as it very often is in later Yeats. Very, very quickly, before proceeding to examine this a bit further in late Yeats, it might be noted that it's a practice that Yeats has favoured in a much less sustained way throughout his writing. There's a very important and familiar one, number 6 on the sheet, which everybody knows. It's what happens at the end of the Second Coming. But I'm invoking it because I think it suggests a more particular reason why Yeats uses broken syntax, so to speak. Now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle, and what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born? Now, as everybody has pointed out, and many people have, under analysis, the last two lines here, like the second line in High Talk, prove to have a double syntactic structure. One's a statement, and one is a question. He says, A, I know what rough beast slouches towards Bethlehem. And then, by putting the question mark at the end, he just seems not to know what rough beast does slouch towards Bethlehem, question mark. Now, what creates the ambiguity is the cunning placing of the question mark at the end. And I think we can dismiss straight away as a possibility, having heard Warwick Gould last week, any question of Yeats doing it by accident. Yeats doesn't make mistakes by mistake. He does it very deliberately. And what this achieves, a brilliant economy in Yeats, as it regularly all the time does in Elizabethan English, which I want to illustrate briefly, is to ask a question without exactly asking it. The question at the end of the Second Coming is, the real question is not what rough beast does towards Bethlehem, but does the eye of the poem know what rough beast this is or not? That's the only question that really survives the syntax of that last sentence. And I think emphatically, Yeats is saying that we don't know the answer. Now, this process might be called something like syntactic catachresis or something like that, as it is by Hillis Miller in his essay on 1919 in The Linguistic Moment, which is one of the great difficult essays on Yeats, because of the way syntactic elements are mixed or misapplied. But in these cases, which become much commoner with Yeats's later passionate syntax, the poet is reversing, as I said in the introduction, with great significance, I think, the correcting movement in English literary history, returning in the way, as I said, that poets like Keats and Leigh Hunt did, the issue of the Cockney school, you know, the sneer of the Cockney school, these people coming along who can't use grammar properly and invading the poetic realm. But it suggests, of course, a distinct advantage, a paradoxical one, in corrected forms and in standard language. That is, you can use, if the rule didn't exist, you can't break it. Therefore, once the rule has been stated and is there to be broken, a whole new set of expressive possibilities arise. In other words, you're not just using illogical constructions, as the 18th century tried to flush out of Elizabethan English. You're also you're doing something slightly different. You are invoking a rule, Yeats's ghostly voice and meter, if you like, something like that. You're invoking that rule in order to say that you're not abiding by it. So you're doing something slightly different. It's not insignificant, I think, that Rosamund Tuve, in her famous book, Elizabethan and Metaphysical Imagery, takes Yeats as the modern poet whose use of syntax repays study, she says, because he bears out how, quote, syntax is the most unobtrusive of all methods of clarification. The closest one can come to the paradox of saying something tacitly. That's putting it beautifully, I think. It's a very, very, very perfect phrase for it, saying something tacitly. In other words, saying something without saying it. Tuve is quoted by Donald Davy in his book Articulate Energy, which, written in the 1950s, remains far and away the best discussion of syntax in English poetry. Of course, why wouldn't it be, he being a previous director of the Yeats Summer School? But it's often been said that along with the advances in clarification then achieved by the formation of a standard language, there went that loss of expressiveness that I mentioned at the beginning. Now, I want to look at Shakespeare's language very briefly as I come towards the end. His language can express confusion or indecisiveness in a way which was not available to the corrected language, which deplored divided usage, believing that any occasion of expression could be resolved correctly. There's one very familiar example. In Mark Antony's speech, and it's significant that it's in a very both dramatic and kind of forensic context. It's a speech, you know, when Antony in Friends, Romans, Countrymen says, okay, Brutus says Caesar was ambitious. And then he says, if it were so, it was a grievous fault. Now, under analysis, we can't say that anymore. Because if it were so, the subjunctive is an unfulfilled condition, according to 18th century rules. If it had been so, we can't say, if it had been so, it was a grievous fault. Those two things kind of clash since the 18th century. But of course, it's extremely useful for Antony's purposes, because he can concede to the audience, who are still rather anti-Caesar at this point, he can concede to them that it was a grievous fault. Okay, I'm not saying it wasn't a fault. If he was ambitious, that was a serious fault. On the other hand, if it were so, has a kind of hint of the unfulfilled condition without actually fully stating that the condition will be unfulfilled. Now, it's slightly, again, it's a refined point, but it's that note, the way that things that are not fully resolved in linguistic concord and correctness can be used in order to constructively muddy the water in that way. The example I put on the sheet, I'll just look at one of them, just look at the Macbeth one, because the Othello one just suggests Othello's confusion, I think. But the Macbeth one is interesting, I think. That's number 7 on the handout sheet. If it were done when 'tis done, then 'twere well it were done quickly. If the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all here, but here, upon this bank and shoal of time, we jump the life to come. Now, as with the second sentence of High Talk, I think this can be offered as a pretty classic example of passionate syntax in action. We know what is meant, though it is not quite what is said, or is not said fully. For instance, what is the antecedent of his in line 4? It was me who italicized it, not Shakespeare, incidentally. I'm not the Shakespeare who italicized anything, but the his is my italic. What is the antecedent of that his? Well, it's the beginning of an act, of a scene. There is nothing before it that helps you. Well, it could be several things grammatically. It could be assassination, consequence, an unexpressed notion of the killing of Duncan. It could even, though not very likely, be what it is normally taken to be, of Duncan himself. It's more likely to be a neuter possessive, the his. But we don't know. There's no satisfactory grammatical resolution of this. And it's exactly what people like Dryden hated about Shakespeare, that you couldn't parse him properly. He was imparsable, they said, in the 18th century. Similarly, how does the that fit in that same line? If the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all here, and so on. I think it doesn't fit logically. As a matter of extremely parochial interest, that usage of that survives in Cork City usage. I don't know of it anywhere else, but it does survive there. In the course of a narrative, you interpose that's as you go along in that sort of way, without it having any fully logical connection with anything else that occurs. Well, that is by the way, except that, of course, it is another instance, of which there are many, of Elizabethan survivals in Irish usage. There are other things too. There's the new noun, the be-all and the end-all, of course. That's a kind of passionate syntax, if you like, in the way that Yeats tries to construct new synthetic constructions. Surcease success is a nice Jacobsonian phonic echo, I think, like swallow and sorrow and love and leave, and maybe talk and stalk, I was suggesting. And it's very easy to multiply examples from Shakespeare, and so I won't go on to the Othello one, which is slightly less satisfactory anyway. So, coming to the conclusion, really, the modernist writer's desire for the creative disruption of syntax should not be thought surprising. The grip of the 18th century idea of grammatical correctness, when you think about it, has remained remarkably absolute in English, and that's the more surprising when you consider how receptive we are to the idea that dividedness in meaning or style can be constructive in poetry. We're very often willing in criticism, and the deconstructionists have almost parodied it, I think, in the extent to which they take it. We're very often willing to say, Well, I mean, this also means, of course. In other words, we don't insist on a unitary meaning in a poem, so why do we insist on unitary structure? Or with Whitman, you know, so I contradict myself. You know, fine, I don't care. But if we admit contradiction of meaning, that might seem to be a much bigger deal, really, than contradiction of structure. But we won't have that. We tend to be very correct in our demands on linguistic structure still. I think Joyce, very finally, can be cited enlighteningly as an instance here. In Ulysses, as often been noted, the words are pretty well all well-formed. The words are recognizable words. And it may very well be that that constraint, the constraint that the words are right, means that the sentences are kind of liberated to be disrupted and using disconnected syntax and often dispensing with punctuation. But if you contrast Finnegan's Wake, you can't have both things. The words, as everybody knows, are all over the place in Finnegan's Wake. The words are things like hole digs for holidays in order to introduce, you know, the idea of hole and digs and so on. But if you're going to use words like that, you can't also disrupt the sentences. It's not possible, I think, it could be argued anyway, to disrupt everything at once and to remain readable at all. Some constraints have got to be abided by, either syntax or individual word formation. Well, like Joyce, Yeats uses different kinds of linguistic experimentation at different stages of his career. But just to summarize on what the nature of those is, finally, in a couple of sentences. And I'm saying that it's something that becomes much more marked, as we can see. The more we look at Last Poems, it seems to me, the more striking this fact is. I've just touched on a couple. There are a whole lot of others. Things like What Magic Drum, for example, which is an odd poem about supernatural songs. Ian Fletcher said a long time ago that the language of supernatural songs is curiously flat, and noted that poem is an exception, because it goes, and precisely the things that he notes are those syntactic breaches. In other words, it behaves like with the kind of life and passion and energy of the last poems in general, of the dramatic last poems, as it seems from the supernatural ones. But what I'm saying is I think, you know, very clear. I've over-stressed it, probably. I mean, my concern partly is that Yeats's language, when he uses abnormal constructions, like what if, when he means what matter if, or those things, very often there's been a tendency to assign that to Irish usage. Even very good discussions of Yeats's language tend to fall into that trap, and I think it explains why people tend to keep away from the language rather cautiously in general. Loretto Todd, for instance, in The Language of Irish Poetry, of Irish Literature, which is a very good book, an excellent book, in fact. But she talks about that William Blake who beat upon a wall, you know, that William Blake. And she does say sort of vaguely, actually, the demonstrative adjective that is used more commonly in general Irish usage than it is in standard English. It's not, actually. Certainly not in that sense. You can't just introduce a new character in Irish speech and say that William Blake, previously unmentioned. But it's a good guess. I mean, she's got as much right to the view as I have, of course. She's Irish too. But I think it's not quite the case. And so on. I think very often it's a kind of principle of modernism and breach of rule that makes Yeats depart from the standard English norm and not Irish practice. And finally of all, what is the purpose of all this? It clearly suggests the dramatic kind of life and vigor that he wants to suggest with the drama of late poems. But I suggest it's also to suggest a kind of uncertainty, an openness in statement, which is the opposite of dogmatism. I think that's very important, really. Yeats very often sounds dogmatic, but as everybody knows, he often opposes dogmatisms to each other. And in a poem like Under Ben Bulben, you get all kinds of things going on, all kinds of views of the world opposed to each other. Was Yeats pro or con violence? You know, I mean, people argue kind of both things very forcefully. And I think that, in a way, correctness, abiding by rule, and breach of rule are another pair of antinomies, like any other Yeatsian antinomy, that he draws on for particular literary and stylistic effects. Thanks very much.